You know, everyone who has ever just sort of dabbled in mindfulness has probably experienced that classic honeymoon phase of meditation. I mean, you download a sleek app, you listen to some soft rain sounds for maybe 10 minutes a day, and you feel noticeably calmer.
Right. You might even go out and splurge on one of those beautifully embroidered velvet meditation cushions.
Exactly. It feels comforting, you know? It's manageable and just incredibly neat.
Oh, yeah. It is very tidy in those early days. You sit down, focus on your breath, your heart rate drops, and you just get up feeling a little more insulated from the stress of the day.
Yeah, it's a very contained experience. But the deeper question we really want to get into is what happens on day 1000?
Or year 10, right?
Right. How do people actually deepen their practice when that initial novelty completely wears off? Like when the app notifications just get ignored and the real, sometimes intensely messy internal work begins?
That transition from the superficial to the structural is exactly what we're looking at today. It is really the shift from using meditation as a temporary stress relief tool to using it as a complete architectural overhaul of how you perceive reality.
Because in today's deep dive, we are exploring a massive stack of personal accounts from long-term Buddhist practitioners. We have sources detailing the lives of a violinist in a major symphony, a forensic psychotherapist, a veterinarian.
And our mission here is to uncover the actual mechanics of a mature practice. We want to know how these people navigate intense, sometimes terrifying psychological awakenings.
Yeah, and how they survive when their spiritual communities totally collapse in scandal. But most importantly, how do they drag these ancient esoteric practices into their completely mundane daily reality?
We are looking at just how robust these ancient technologies have to be to survive contact with the modern world.
So, whether you consider yourself a seasoned meditator or you are just insanely curious about human psychology, this dive is going to reveal how mastering your mind operates as the ultimate life hack, especially for navigating a completely chaotic world.
Absolutely. And what stands out immediately in these sources is that the transition out of the honeymoon phase, it rarely happens with a gentle, polite tap on the shoulder.
No, not at all. We see that moving beyond that beginner stage often involves an intense, totally destabilizing realization, or like a sudden somatic experience that just shatters the practitioner's current paradigm.
It essentially forces a deeper commitment simply because they can't unsee what they've just seen. It frequently arrives like a psychological shockwave.
We get a very literal example of this shockwave in the accounts with a practitioner named Aaron. So Aaron is 18 years old, he's heading off to college, and he gets a hold of a yoga text.
A very specific kind of yoga text, right?
Yeah, and he skips right past all the foundational stuff and goes straight to the advanced breathing exercises in the back, the pranayama section. And this section comes with explicit warnings not to attempt the techniques without an experienced teacher.
Which, naturally, is the first thing an 18-year-old brain is going to try to do.
Oh, of course. So he dives in recklessly, and it triggers what he describes as a massive kundalini awakening. And for anyone listening who hears the word awakening and thinks of like a peaceful, glowing aura, this was definitely not that.
No, not at all.
He actually described the experience as borderline psychotic.
Right, because kundalini in these yogic and esoteric traditions refers to a massive release of latent physical and mental energy. When you tap into that without any preparation, it isn't peaceful at all.
It sounds terrifying, honestly.
It is a violent rewiring of the nervous system. He essentially has this roaring electrical energy surging through his body.
And it is clashing violently with his typical college lifestyle, right? Because he's
Ah.
still partying, drinking, smoking weed, engaging in casual hookups.
Yeah, the juxtaposition there is extreme.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. If Aaron is lighting up his nervous system like a Christmas tree, but maintaining that chaotic lifestyle, it feels like taking a cheap commuter car and dropping a 1,000-horsepower engine into it.
That is a brilliant way to put it.
Right, but he's completely ignoring the brakes and the cheap, worn-out tires. You are basically guaranteeing that you're going to spin out and crash. So why is the foundational stuff, like the ethics and the lifestyle, so critical before getting to the cool advanced meditations?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, in traditional yogic and Buddhist systems, there is a very strict reason why you spend years mastering ethics and basic lifestyle precepts first. Those ethics act as your grounding rod.
Okay.
Advanced meditation does not magically make you a saint. It actually acts as an amplifier for whatever is already in your subconscious.
Wait, so it amplifies the bad stuff too?
Exactly. If you have unresolved delusions, deep anxieties, or addictive habits, pumping massive amounts of raw focus and energy into your system just supercharges those exact negative patterns.
So you aren't just meditating away the bad habits. You could accidentally be feeding them high-octane fuel.
Precisely. Aaron eventually had to use an intensely physical form of Ashtanga yoga for years just to physically ground his nervous system. He had to burn through those addiction cravings so he could actually hold that mental energy safely.
Wow. And that physical explosive catalyst is just so different from another account we have from a woman named Jackie. Jackie's shockwave was entirely psychological.
Right. She was coming from a totally different background.
Yeah. She was an agnostic atheist, completely grounded in science and her career as a veterinarian. But one night, she has this incredibly vivid, lucid dream of a Tibetan monk standing in her garden.
Just out of nowhere.
Totally out of nowhere. She witnesses this elaborate, colorful procession leaving gifts in her yard. It was so overwhelmingly real that she literally woke up, drove to a bookstore, and bought every single text on Tibetan Buddhism she could get her hands on.
Which really shows us that the catalyst doesn't always have to be an energetic overload like Aaron's. It can be a profound, spontaneous, mystical opening.
But the function is basically identical, right?
Yeah, both Aaron and Jackie experienced something that broke their previous understanding of reality and demanded a serious investigation.
But the sources suggest that investigation eventually hits a hard wall if you just keep browsing. Jackie talks about how she spent a long time going to different retreats, reading various books, and sampling different teachers.
She was doing what a lot of people do, the buffet approach.
Exactly. Wow. A little bit of Zen meditation here, a little bit of secular mindfulness there. But she realizes that if you are digging 10 shallow wells, you are going to get a lot of mud, but you are never going to hit clear water.
That is such a crucial realization in long-term practice. Deep psychological transformation requires a singular, unbroken container.
You have to commit.
Yes, you have to commit to one specific architecture to actually reach the bottom of the mind. Jackie ultimately chose to dig her single well in the Bon tradition, which is an indigenous Tibetan lineage that stretches back something like 13,000 years.
That kind of unfathomable timeline brings us heavily into the concept of lineage and why finding a single authentic teacher is so critical. Aaron's account actually issues a major warning about what he calls fractured lineages.
Right. He argues that in the modern spiritual marketplace, you really have to actively look for red flags.
Because a trustworthy teacher in these traditions is generally someone who has spent decades training under another recognized, accountable master, right? They possess an unbroken line of transmission.
Exactly. Aaron is warning against this modern phenomenon where someone studies a tradition for maybe 3 or 4 years, decides they understand it perfectly, and breaks off to start their own pop-up spiritual brand.
If a teacher didn't possess the humility and patience to see their own intense training through to the end, relying on them to guide you through your darkest psychological blind spots seems incredibly dangerous.
It is. The container of a lineage matters because an authentic teacher's primary job is to see the exact blind spots your ego is desperately trying to hide. They are a mirror.
We see that mirror effect so vividly with Joe Evans. Joe is a violinist, and he had this transformative encounter with his teacher, a Dzogchen master named Kenpo Choga Rinpoche.
That's a fascinating story.
It really is. Joe was struggling with what his teacher identified as cold pride. We usually think of pride as arrogant, right? Like hot pride, walking around thinking you're superior to everyone else.
Well, cold pride is very different.
Yeah, it is pure self-degradation. It's the belief that I am so uniquely broken and bad that no one, not even this ancient practice, can fix me.
That is a phenomenal diagnosis by the teacher, because self-loathing is still a paralyzing form of ego. It is still an intense obsession with the self.
So true. And Joe's teacher looked right through this protective layer of self-pity, right in front of a room full of people, and simply told Joe, "You need to think you're good." That simple, piercing reflection just completely shattered Joe's habitual narrative.
It cut right through the noise.
I am struggling with this part of the process, though, hearing about this intense teacher-student dynamic and this concept of guru devotion that comes up in these texts. Aren't we, as modern Westerners, completely ill-equipped for that?
What do you mean?
Well, we value individualism so highly. It seems like handing over your psychological agency to a guru is just setting people up to be exploited by a charismatic leader. Like, we even have Jude, a psychotherapist, warning about the risks of this resembling a bad therapeutic relationship.
What's fascinating here is that your skepticism is not only valid, it is highly protective. We really do not have a cultural framework in the West for surrendering our ego to a spiritual teacher without immediately suspecting a cult dynamic.
Right, it feels super sketchy.
And sometimes those suspicions are incredibly accurate, but in an authentic, unbroken lineage, true teachers do not want your worship. The devotion is actually a psychological technology.
Yeah.
You aren't idolizing the flawed human being sitting on the cushion in front of you.
Yeah.
You are using them as a physical proxy for your own highest untapped potential. The ultimate goal of this dynamic isn't to remain dependent on a guru forever.
It's to grow past them.
Basically, it is to train your perception so intensely that eventually you view every person and every challenge in your life as your teacher.
Oh, wow. So it's less about serving a master and more about using the master to learn how to serve reality.
Exactly that.
Which transitions perfectly into what happens when these practitioners actually step off the meditation cushion. Because deepening a practice clearly doesn't mean moving to a cave in the Himalayas.
No, it really doesn't.
The real crucible is dragging these highly esoteric ancient practices directly into the mundane, frustrating reality of a Tuesday afternoon.
Right. If the architecture you are building in your mind collapses the moment you are tired, annoyed, or facing professional stress, it isn't a mature practice. It's just a hobby.
Let's look at Jackie again, working as a veterinarian. When she is facing a nerve-wracking, high-stakes surgery on an animal, she doesn't just close her eyes and take a deep breath to calm down. She uses advanced tantric visualization.
Which sounds intense for a vet clinic.
It is. She visualizes the Red Garuda. It's this incredibly powerful, fiery, winged deity with sharp claws. But how does picturing a mythical bird actually help a surgeon fix an animal?
It is a brilliant example of a biofeedback hack. By intensely visualizing the Garuda, she is actively giving her nervous system a highly specific, powerful anchor.
Instead of just panicking.
Exactly. If she doesn't do that, her mind will naturally loop on fear. What if my hand slips? What if this animal dies? That fear activates the amygdala, flooding her with adrenaline and making her hands shake.
So the visualization stops that physical reaction.
Yes. By completely occupying her mental bandwidth with the fierce, protective, confident attributes of the Garuda, she overrides the anxiety response. She's deliberately changing her neurochemistry in real time to serve the patient on the table.
That is wild. And Joe Evans does something very similar with the Utah Symphony. He was struggling with the interpersonal drama of a major orchestra and the intense, suffocating pressure of performing at that level.
Performance anxiety is huge in that field.
Huge. And he brings this anxiety to his teacher. And his teacher doesn't give him a breathing technique. He just says, play joyfully.
Just like that.
Yeah. And Joe changes his entire framework. Instead of viewing his violin solo as a high-stakes test of his ego, he actively uses the performance as a practice of generating happiness for the audience.
He fundamentally shifted his intention. The notes he plays are exactly the same, but the psychological weight behind them is entirely different.
And it gets even more granular than an operating room or a symphony stage. Look at the account of Jude and Emma. They are high school sweethearts. They've been married for over 20 years, raising kids and juggling these intense careers.
That's a lot of daily stress.
Totally. Jude is a forensic psychotherapist navigating what he hilariously calls the sea of ego squirts on LinkedIn. He has to wear this heavy professional armor to survive in his field. But the real challenge is taking that armor off the second he walks through his front door.
Because a 20-year marriage builds up a massive amount of habitual psychological tension. Jude actually refers to their codependent relationship habits as a glob of tangled reactions.
Yes, the glob. And they don't just sit in silence to deal with it. They actively use Buddhist analysis. Specifically, they apply the concept of emptiness to their marital arguments.
Which can sound very weird to a beginner.
Very weird. To a layperson, applying emptiness to your spouse makes it sound like you just check out, stop caring, and stare blankly at them while they yell.
Right. But emptiness is one of the most frequently misunderstood translations in Western Buddhism. It does not mean a void, and it certainly doesn't mean apathy.
So what does it actually look like for them?
In this context, emptiness means realizing that your perspective, your absolute certainty that your spouse is wrong and you are right, is not a solid, fixed reality. It is empty of permanence.
Ah, okay.
When Jude and Emma apply this during an argument, they are recognizing that their anger is just a temporary collision of conditions. It allows them to step back, untangle the glove, and stop treating their passing emotions as absolute truth.
Jude applies this in real-time parenting, too. He talks about his kids screaming because they just lost a match in the video game Fortnite.
A classic modern parenting struggle.
Absolutely. But instead of just yelling at them to be quiet because he's annoyed, he taps into the concept of impermanence. He realizes, like, this intense frustration is a completely real reality for my kids right now, but it is guaranteed to pass.
He is using the fundamental teachings, the Dharma, to just de-escalate a modern living room.
So what does this all mean? Because Jude also shares this incredibly surreal story. He is walking through a Costco with his teacher, who is a Tibetan monk. And there, sitting on a discount pallet right next to the Rachel Ray cookbooks, is a massive, glossy book full of highly secretive Vajrayana deities.
Vajrayana being the highly esoteric advanced methods of Tibetan Buddhism meant to really fast-track psychological transformation.
Right. And Jude's teacher points out that traditionally, a monk would spend 30 years undergoing grueling preparation just to be granted permission to look at one of these images. And here it is in a warehouse club in America for $20.
A pretty jarring contrast.
It is. Finding these psychological blueprints next to a cookbook feels like finding military-grade flight simulator software in the toy aisle. Does this massive modern accessibility just completely dilute the power of the practice? Or does it force practitioners to be more authentic?
Well, it highlights the great paradox of modern mindfulness. We have successfully democratized the information. You can buy the deepest secrets of human consciousness in bulk at Costco. But democratization is not actualization. Reading the flight simulator manual doesn't mean you can fly the plane.
That makes a lot of sense.
The transformation of the mind still requires putting in the daily grueling reps. The true test of a deep practice isn't how many secret texts you have on your coffee table. It is whether you can access that profound patience when your kids are screaming about a video game.
But what happens when the challenge isn't just a video game or a stressful day at work? What happens when the very community that is supposed to support you through this grueling mental training completely shatters?
That is a very tough pivot.
It is, because the narrative in these sources shifts into the absolute darkest phase of long-term practice, when the human elements of the tradition fail you entirely.
And this is a devastating reality that many modern practitioners are just forced to navigate.
We have the account of Kim H. She was a deeply dedicated practitioner in a spiritual community called Against the Stream, and that entire community collapsed. It was destroyed by a massive Me Too scandal involving the leadership.
It's awful.
Kim details the absolute heartbreak of watching a sacred, safe space be shattered by human corruption. And it carries even more weight because this specific community was a refuge for people in addiction recovery.
Which makes it so much worse.
These were people relying on this space for their literal survival, and the leadership just completely abused that trust.
The psychological damage of losing your spiritual refuge like that, it just cannot be overstated.
I have to lean in and play the skeptic here for a second for anyone listening. If these teachings are so powerful and these teachers meditate for decades and supposedly master their own minds, why do they still fall prey to basic human corruption and ego?
This raises an important question, and it is honestly the most painful question in modern spiritual communities. But the crucial Buddhist lesson hidden within this tragedy is separating the timeless teachings from the impermanent, flawed human teacher.
Okay, so the tool isn't the problem, the user is.
Yes. Meditation is a tool. It does not magically render a human immune to the corrupting influence of unchecked power or psychological blind spots. The failure of a teacher is a brutal, real-time lesson in impermanence.
And a reminder not to put humans on pedestals.
Exactly. The container cracked, yes, but the efficacy of the techniques themselves did not change. Kim realized that while the leadership failed, the sangha, the community of practitioners holding each other accountable, was still vital. You learn to internalize your refuge rather than outsourcing it.
Which brings us to the ultimate payoff. Decades of grueling inner work, surviving community scandals, untangling your marriage, dealing with terrifying energetic awakenings. What is the actual fruit of all this labor?
Because the sources make it clear that the goal isn't levitation.
Right. And it certainly isn't an endless, undisturbed state of bliss.
The masterpiece of a mature practice is incredibly pragmatic. It yields sharp discernment, unshakable resilience, and genuine freedom.
Aaron notes that the ultimate fruit is discernment. It is the hard-won ability to just let go of the stories, the marketing, and the dead institutions that are driving modern society.
You simply stop operating on the world's broken autopilot.
Joe Evans defines it in an even more accessible way. He says true happiness is simply decreasing negative thinking moment by moment. It is the freedom of recognizing a tornado of professional jealousy forming in your mind and actively replacing it with genuine rejoicing for someone else's success.
Which is incredibly hard to do in practice.
Oh, for sure. But the most profound illustration of this masterpiece comes from Kim H. She watched her father, who had been a dedicated Vipassana practitioner his entire life, suffer a massive stroke.
Vipassana is insight meditation, where you closely observe the raw physical sensations of the body.
Right. So her father ends up in the ICU facing his own mortality. And Kim watches him handle this terrifying, painful reality with total grace and absolutely zero fear. He simply utilized his decades of observing sensation to accept the stroke as the natural, impermanent process of a physical body aging. Watching him, Kim had this massive realization that her life's practice actually is her masterpiece.
Building that quiet confidence.
Yes. The unshakable confidence that she can handle literally any crisis life throws at her. It really is like building a psychological immune system.
That is the perfect analogy.
You aren't trying to stop the germs from existing, the bad days, the annoying coworkers, or even serious illnesses. You are building an internal processing system so robust that when they do hit, you just process them and keep moving.
True freedom, as Joe noted, isn't about escaping the world or chasing temporary sense pleasures. It is the absolute cessation of being held hostage by your own reactive, negative thoughts.
Which means the honeymoon phase we talked about at the very beginning is just completely on. Deepening a practice is not a straight line. It is turbulent.
It requires awakenings that shatter your worldview and seeking out tough teachers.
And confronting your professional armor before you sit down to dinner with your family. It means surviving the heartbreak of flawed institutions and ultimately turning your own mind into a masterpiece of resilience.
And if there is one incredibly practical takeaway from all of this, it is a final thought shared by Joe Evans that everyone should ponder.
Oh, I love this one.
He pointed out that every single person, no matter how difficult, possesses some level of good thinking. And therefore, everyone you meet is effectively a part of your sangha, your spiritual community.
So true.
Think about what would happen to your daily stress if you treated every single frustrating person you encounter today not as an obstacle, but as a flawed, unwitting sparring partner in your own personal training camp.
That is just taking the work off the cushion and directly into the chaos. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and whatever you do, keep putting in the reps.